We bless him, and he's been here many years. And you might tell us, if you have time, how a young scholar like you found your way all the way over here. You know, he's going to be a blessing to our hearts.
I don't think I even need it, actually. Okay. Good morning. Good morning. Very nice to see everybody. Oh, that's louder, isn't it? Very nice. I see some long-time familiar friends and acquaintances and colleagues, and I see some folks who, next time I see you, I can say the same thing. Yeah, as it comes. I hear a couple of themes this morning. One theme is how we can get to know Jesus better. And I think that many of us are involved in doing that here, both personally and professionally. I know that. I know that to be the case. That's certainly what brings me to this land for the last 20 years or so. The detail is how we do it and what we do specifically, and that will vary. But why we're here, I think, is the same for all of us. To get to know Jesus better through Bible, and to help others see and know and believe the same. And that encourages me. The secondary theme was grandchildren. And that gets picked up a couple of times. I see I was sitting in the family section over on this side, and that I like. It reminds me of my two grandkids back home. And that we don't see them nearly as often as we should. And my wife and I look forward to the time when we can get all those reunited times together again, which I can see are nice, yeah? Amen. Where are yours? Oklahoma City. I've heard of the place. Never been there, but heard of the place. And I've got some of my own, but good. Good. Good for you. Good for you. When I saw Chuck at an occasion a few months ago, he invited our time together this morning, and I appreciate that. Where did you go? There you are. Thank you. Thank you. You didn't tell me how much time I had. A bit. Okay. All right. From what we've done this morning, from those of us who have shared with each other already, I realize I have nothing to add. That's it. And I know sometimes past preachers and people up here or another behind other pulpits say that, you know, to get a bit of sympathy. But in this case, I really don't have much to add. And so what I think I'll do is remind us of some things that we already know, keeping in mind the statement, I think it's Ephesians chapter 3, somewhere along 18, 19, something like that, that the love of Jesus surpasses knowledge. And the fellowship that we have in Jesus, it's pretty much full stop at that point, even though we may be involved in different aspects of what he has for our lives in different places. Let me start with something I shared with Chuck a few months ago. It's a 46-word definition of church history. I know there are big, fat books written on church history, too many, actually. Here it is in 46 words, all right? And in the sake of giving the proper footnote, this was said by the then chaplain of the U.S. Senate back in the Reagan-Bush years, a guy named Richard Halverson. Maybe some of you might know or remember his name. He said this: the church began as a fellowship of men and women centered on Jesus Christ. It went to Greece and became a philosophy. It went to Rome and became an institution. It went to Europe and became a culture. It came to America and became an enterprise. Oops. Oops. You know, the church it's a very diverse group of people. It's full, it's rich, it's colorful. A great mosaic, a tapestry of color and texture. fitting, wrapping itself around and through every culture and people group worldwide. And that's absolutely tremendous. And at the same time, you know, anthropologists study it. Politicians court it or try to suppress it. Marketers exploit it. Theologians circumscribe it here and there. War strategists appeal to it. Hollywood belittles it. And to be fair, whenever it can, the church returns the compliment. Yeah? The church is something worth living for. It's something that we busy ourselves with. It's something worth dying for. The church triumphant and struggling. The church channeling God's blessings. The church sometimes just getting by. So God bless the church. Yeah. Both for what it's become and in spite of what it too often is. But what about Jesus? Yeah? What about Jesus? The church began as a fellowship of men and women centered on Jesus Christ. Full stop. Full stop. Yeah? You can learn a lot from students. Some of us have been such. You can learn a lot from students. I get interesting notes from them sometimes. Sometimes they show up on emails, you know, should I come and, you know, study with you? Or some show up on applications to impress me. All right, here's one. I have wavered a little bit recently. I've started to go to different churches. However, one thing I know for sure is that I don't believe in any religion anymore. I simply believe in the salvation of Jesus Christ. I'm not sure what to do with that. I'll need this eventually as well. Thank you. I'm not sure what to do with that. Several things bother me about the statement, but I get the essence. Yeah? I just believe in the salvation of Jesus. Now, the Bible is so rich, it is just jammed full of statements of realities that become images of a different kind of reality. We heard a bit about that with, for instance, water. Water is a thing. It's an object, yeah? I bet you didn't know I was going to say that right then, yeah? Water is a material object. This land needs more of it. It's a reality in this land, and it becomes in many ways, including what we heard this morning, images of Jesus and the provision that he gives. In the Bible, there's a set of data that we can study as historical geography, and there's a study of the same data, the way it was used in the text, literary geography. That's the scholarly part of this. And the two are interwoven constantly, as we saw even this morning. A lot of images, you know, a lot of them. One of them that helps me understand a bit, the idea of what it means to be in a fellowship of men and women with Jesus, is the reality of sheep. Another very common reality described in the Bible from the very beginning. It has all kinds of associations. We'll get to that in just a bit. But a statement written by one of the shepherds, Moses, who spent a good deal of time with sheep and goats and then an equal amount of time with people as sheep and goats, shepherding them through the same area that had no water either time, basically. And I want to start with a very, I think, insightful two lines in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, toward the end of the Pentateuch. There is in chapter 32 a poem, which is as much of as anything else a creation story. We have the creation story in Genesis 1 and 2 of the land, and I think in Genesis 32 of the people who are going to be living there. A lot of the language is similar. Sometimes it comes through in English, but for sure in the Hebrew. A lot of the language is similar. And an introduction here is this. And to me, it says something about the essence of what Jesus wants in terms of relationship or fellowship. It's this. Verse 8, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of man, he set the boundaries for the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. Verse 9, but the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. The Lord's portion is his people. Now, think, if you will, of all of the place names that are mentioned in the Bible, and there's a lot of them, where the divine name, the revealed name to Moses at the burning bush, is part of that place name. There aren't any. There's a grand total of zero. There's none. And think about the personal names in the Bible, people names, where the divine name that God revealed himself, the essence, the life name, the I am who I am name, the one that breathes life and being, shows up as a part of a name of a person. There's a lot of them. You know, all the names that start with Joe or end in Yah, to be quite honest. Yeah, Elijah and Isaiah and all these guys, Joel. There's a lot of them. We identify ourselves personally, our own identity, with his. And that begins a relationship. And in the Pentateuch, we have a lot of relational language. Starts in Genesis chapter 1, when chapter 2, when God walks in the cool of the day and talks face to face, as it were, with Adam and Eve. It's very relational. It's very fellowship. Let's say it's pre-church in its essence. From the beginning, established from the beginning. Personal relationship, fellowship of men and women centered on Jesus Christ is where we find the strongest loyalty and the strongest commitment. And that way it's very Middle Eastern, I guess. Not just Middle Eastern. Loyalty and commitment. And this is where the sheep stuff comes in. So nicely. All that stuff you hear about sheep is probably true. You know, these kind of things that just follow along each other blindly in blind trust and loyalty. Let me tell you a story. This is one that illustrates for me the line in John chapter 10 when Jesus says the sheep hear my voice. You know, they know the voice of the shepherd. And some of you, I'm sure, have been here long enough and in contexts close enough to the reality to know how that works. You've heard that work? Yeah. A few years ago, I'm with a school on Mount Zion. Actually, it's still called the American Institute legally in Israel. We never changed the name in Israel. And I kind of like that, actually. Jerusalem University College is the public name other places. And we share property. We are property of the Anglican Church, long-term forever rights. But behind us is the Protestant cemetery on Mount Zion. And the access gate for the public is through our campus gardens. And the fence in the back of the cemetery is not what it should be. And the cemetery has been in the news recently because of damage and so on, because people crawling over the fence. But a few years ago, we went back there. It was the heat of the summer, and there's trees back there. It's a little bit shady and breezy, and there was an entire flock of sheep in the cemetery sleeping under the trees, kind of the same color as the gravestones and the rocks. There were well over 100 of them, and the shepherd off somewhere. Well, you know, I'm all for sheep sleeping, but the cemetery on Mount Zion is probably not the place where that should be happening. And so I got our campus manager, William Cupty, and we went back there, and we said, you know, we very much like you. Thank you for coming, but probably you shouldn't be sleeping here. And the shepherd does what the shepherds do best, you know. It's a sound. It's not exactly, I'll look at my linguists here, my linguist friends, right? It's not exactly human speech, and it's not exactly sheep speech. It's something in between. Yeah, you've heard this sound. Yep. And yeah, And although each shepherd does it slightly different than the other, they know the voice of their own shepherd. And it was almost like computer animation. All 100-plus sheep at the same instant went from sleeping to head up at the very same time. And then he did it again, do it again. And they all turned at the voice. It's like a computer did it all together. And then he stood up, and they all stood up, went out the hole in the back. I mean, unbelievable. You've seen it. Yeah? You've seen it. Unbelievable. That's loyalty. It's absolute loyalty to a voice, to a sound, and to a command. It's tremendous stuff. And what that does is it prompts the same kind of loyalty and commitment within the body. And that's what I heard this morning, and that's why I say I have nothing to add. I've seen it. Yeah, it's here. It's here, that kind of loyalty. One psalm that I read to all of our students, first thing up, just off the plane, some of them, you know, 3 o'clock until now, they're that early in the land. And I'll read them Psalm 122, which is a psalm of ascent coming up to Jerusalem. And I love the songs of ascent because they are very tightly working with a relationship between God and people and a place where God reveals himself in special ways, Jerusalem. And the city of Jerusalem almost becomes a living entity, part of this triad, God, people, and place. Psalm 122, it's one that you know quite well. There's some quite well-known lines in here. Let me read the whole thing quickly. I think it's only 9 verses long, but I want to focus on this point only on the last verse. But for the context, I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go to the house of the Lord. Our feet are standing within your gates, O Jerusalem." That's the one I get our students to get excited about because our campus is built on the wall of the city in Jesus' day in the time of the late Old Testament when Hezekiah was king and beyond and probably when the psalm was read. And I say, now you've kept the verse, right? Finally in your life you've kept the verse. "Our feet are standing within your gates, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem that is built as a city compact together to which the tribes go up, even the tribes of the Lord." It's an ordinance. You're supposed to do it, it says. "For their thrones were set for judgment, thrones for the house of David." The statement here in the first half of the psalm is one of an ideal situation, almost an eschatological situation, to use the language of that we heard with the parasha section today, of life the way it's supposed to be. And then in my English version here, there's a bit of a gap before the next verse, meaning take a pause. At least the way the editors understood this to be. And it says, and here's the famous verse, "Pray for the peace of Jerusalem." And the implication is we're not there yet, the way it's supposed to be. "Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper who love you. May peace be within your walls, prosperity within your palaces." That's what we want. "For the sake of my brothers and my friends, I will now say, may peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good." And that's the key. That's the loyalty and the commitment section of the psalm. Notice very carefully the pronoun. May peace, life the way it's supposed to be. When Jesus said, "I have come to give life and life abundantly," this is part of the context of what he is saying. May peace be with, what's the pronoun? You. "For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek," what's the pronoun? "Your good." And the word good, of course, always, not always, but often enough, this technical term that takes us back to Eden, God made and it was the way it's supposed to be, good. And notice, it's the loyalty of God to people that is now supposed to stick to people. If I can use the New Testament term, within the church, where we seek the good, the way the life is supposed to be, not for ourselves, for each other. I grew up in a part of the world at a time of history when we were taught from little up to take care of ourselves first. I heard on TV yesterday somebody who said, that he learned that he shouldn't be taking care of himself, he should be taking care of his family. That's good. Enough families, that doesn't happen. But it's not that much different. It's still within the household. And notice what the psalmist says. Don't need to take care of yourself. God takes care of others, will do that. I will look for your peace, you will look for mine. That's the implication. That's the commitment and loyalty that the psalmist senses, that I think is deeply rooted in the phrase the church began as a fellowship of men and women centered on Jesus Christ. Through the image of the shepherd and many other things shows what that means. All right. The personal relationship is not just where we find the strongest loyalty and commitment, but it's where we find the strongest grace. The strongest grace. And this is really the good news. Grace is something that we tend to want for ourselves more than we tend to want it to others. Unmerited favor is what the theologians correctly call it. Unmerited favor. But it's the unpart that we don't quite want to accept. Merited favor, I'll give you. Unmerited? That's the hard one. And as you know, the world is full of people who really don't deserve it. And that includes us. And by us, I mean me. I'll change the pronoun. It's the unmerited part. A personal relationship is where that grace develops and is shown the strongest. The fellowship of men and women under Jesus Christ. That's the lost sheep image. You know Luke 15? I won't take time to read it, but you know the parable, Luke 15? 99 are where they should be and are left in the open pasture, and the guy goes out and finds the one who may not want to be found, actually. All right? Maybe it wasn't just dumb enough to wander off on its own, but maybe intentionally wandered off on its own. Didn't want to be found. Unmerited grace is let him find you. Let him find you. It helps if we don't focus on the qualities of sheepness. Most of them aren't particularly attractive. It helps if we focus on the qualities of the shepherd, who the shepherd is. A couple more statements I got from students. This one was on an application. It has to remain anonymous. All right? But here it is. I know I'm not supposed to share things on applications. These are confidential, but we'll kind of blot out the personal parts. Here's what it says. As a student at JUC, I know that I would be an asset to your school in many ways. On my graduation day from university, I was heavily decorated with awards that signified how God had used me to do well to others. I can honestly tell you that I feel like the most blessed person on the face of the planet. Wow. I don't know. He ended up not coming. I guess he figured out we had nothing to teach him. You know, there he is. All right. That's a quality of sheepness. You know, I don't want to be found. I'm good enough. Here's another one. I like this one better. None of us are strong enough to tackle or catch or dodge all the world has to throw at us. None of us are strong enough to tackle, catch, or dodge everything the world throws at us. That one I think is pretty accurate. I think for everybody. But we need to focus on the qualities of the shepherd. And you know, the shepherd is in many ways the most foundational occupation that we have in this book. Who were shepherds? Abel, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, Moses, David. I mean, that's a pretty good list. It's a pretty significant list. And of course, Jesus, who was raised as a tecton, as a skilled worker in local building material, and then rabbi, said, no, also shepherd, the good one. and Peter, that fisherman. What happened to him in John 21? You know the story, John 21? I'll look here and back in Deuteronomy, and then I'll let you go. John 21. There's so much in terms of spots that we can look. John 21, you know, after the resurrection, after Peter had been called to be a fisherman of people, yeah? Not a fisherman, right? I guess, to be called. And after all those years, John, according to the Gospel of John, 3 years, they were together around the lake and other places, back to Jerusalem, here and there, all these kinds of things. By the way, where is Peter at the crucifixion? John shows up. Mary shows up. When Jesus needed him most. And in John 21, we have the statement, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? You know, Jesus says that 3 times. And if you know a little bit of the Greek behind it, you know, Jesus says, do you agape me? Really, 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 you know, unconditionally love me? And what does Peter say? He uses that other word. We can be friends. Phileo. And Jesus does it again. Do you really, really, really love me? We can be friends. We can be friends? We can be friends. And scholars kind of tap dance around why this change of the Greek term and why Jesus in the end says, you know, the phileo, or the friendship term and all of that. And is it stylistic? I sort of think Jesus is at this point going to take what he can get with Peter. You know, give him the book of Acts. Peter's going to become somebody, you know, bold. But in the meantime, but in each case, what does Jesus say? Does he say, Peter, do you love me? Catch my fish. Peter, do you love me? Catch my fish. What does he say? Feed my sheep. Take care of my lambs. And Peter gets a new occupation, basically, or a new image for what he is. A new occupation. And it makes a lot of sense. You know, think about the fish for a minute. They're very happy in the lake all by themselves. They don't want to be caught. They want to hide from the hook or the net. They don't need the fishermen. In fact, they try to avoid the fishermen as much as they can. And they get along just fine, flapping around in the bottom of the sea. Life is good. And when they're caught by the fishermen, what happens to the fish? They die. Not a very good picture of the church. Although once in a while, maybe it's been that way. I don't know. But what about sheep? The relationship between the two. The sheep and the shepherd. You know, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. There is no time off. Zero. The shepherd smells like the sheep after a while. Looks like the sheep. If you've seen some of these guys out in the, yeah? Eats the same stuff off the ground sometimes. You can't carry that much food with you if you're out there. So graze with them, actually, off the bushes and things. And love them so much. Talk to some of these guys if you can. Love them. They'd rather do nothing else. I just love my sheep. That's the picture. The unconditional to keep showing loyalty and commitment and grace to keep the sheep alive. To keep them alive. And that's the church. That's the fellowship of men and women with Jesus Christ, which began in this city. One more image, and I'll leave you here. Back to Deuteronomy 32, the creation story of people. Genesis 32. Sorry, Deuteronomy 32, my mistake. Deuteronomy 32, the Pentateuch is nearly over at this point in its form. The Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, the allotment of his inheritance. And here's the creation thing. I'll do it very fast. He found him in a desert land, in the howling wasteland of a wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young, that spread his wings and caught them and carried them in his pinions. The language here is open Sinai language. Howling, empty wilderness. And the big birds that look for prey, you know, pick it up and carry it away. The howling wasteland. I love it in the English. Tohu. It's the same thing you have in Genesis 1. And the earth was formless and void. And here the eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. And the language here is evocative of creating the land, only now we're creating the people to be on it. But this is the line I want to show you. He guarded him as the apple of his eye. Now that's an English idiom. And as you know, there's a Hebrew word for apple, and that's not this word, actually. That's a Hebrew idiom. Sorry, that's an English idiom, the apple of his eye. Better translation might be the pupil of your eye. That's what my English version actually here, the New American Standard says, the pupil of his eye. And from this, everybody talks about endearment and all these kinds of things. But where does that actually come from? The word actually is little man, Ishon. Little man. How does that help? Is that better than an apple in your eye? Is there a little man in your eye? Actually, there is. And here we'll have audience participation at the very end, all right? So look at your neighbor. Take off your glasses. It works better if there's a strong light or if you're out in the sunshine. And look in the eyes, the pupils of the eyes of your neighbor, and tell me what you see. Or if the light isn't strong enough, I'll tell you what you should see. What do you see? What do you see? Get close enough to see, yeah? It's maybe too dark in here to tell. Chuck, what do you see? Of the lights, because you're not close enough to Liz. That's why. All right. Where? You see yourself in Chuck's pupil. All right? Guys, when I do this with down at Tantur with the priests and nuns, it's a little awkward, right? But they get the idea. But they get the, yeah, they get the idea. What do you see? You see yourself inside the eye of the other person. He guards him as the little man of his eye. All right, now fill in the pronoun. God, the Lord God, by now we know his personal living name, guards you as the little man of his eye, which means to fill out the image, if you look, we're not supposed to look in God's face to face, right? All that language in the Bible, except here you do. When you look in God's eyes, what do you see deep inside of him? You. And when he looks in your eyes, what does he see deep inside of you? Him. Yeah? Which is another poetic way of saying we're made in his image. Right? There's something there that's meant to be. Something there that's meant to be. Something of essence, of identity, of life, of reality. Even though we have to use images to talk about it. Yeah? That's the fellowship of men and women with Jesus. Yeah? Even though the word church isn't mentioned here yet. It takes a shepherd to tell us this. Moses himself. It's not an enterprise, not a culture, not an institution, not a philosophy, not a theology, even though we like to write big books and talk about all sorts of circumscribed differences that way, a fellowship full of loyalty, full of commitment, and in the words of Jesus, full of grace and truth. Yeah? And that's what y'all have. But you knew that. You knew that already. Yeah? Pray with me. Lord God, thank you for these reminders as deep as the beginning of the Bible itself of the fellowship, the relationship, the loyalty, the grace that you so much desire to want to have with people and for each and every one of us who senses and knows and responds and is wanting to be a part of that. And we also pray for all of those who don't know that yet, who don't see it yet, and who need to be shown and told, whether they're in this city or this land or parts of the world beyond. Some of them are back home as well. And so for each person here involved in helping others learn who you are better through Bible and face to face, we thank you for all the efforts that by your grace we're privileged to be a part of. We thank you. And we know that in spite of our sheepness, that if we keep our eyes on you and in you and follow, that your will is done. And for that we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. So, yay, Shabbat Shalom.